We have a wonderful speaker with a lot of talent and credentials. Of course, you're aware that this is a Bud Schieffer Memorial Lecture, and Bud was an outstanding member of the community and was involved in many things, especially the mikveh and with the Chevra Kedisha and setting up shiva houses. And even though he was a Kohen, he did his part even in that mitzvah. At this point, I'd like to call on Aaron Stiefel, brother's son, to say a few words.
On behalf of my mother and sisters, I want to thank you all for coming, and particularly I want to thank Harold, who put this evening together. It is indeed a proud time for us in that the shul continues to remember my father and pay tribute to him in this way. And it's comforting to us that there is this annual opportunity for communal learning in his memory. And it is indeed it has been over the years a wonderful program, excellent speakers every year. I'm sure tonight will be no different. It's obviously difficult to say anything that it really means a lot in just a few minutes, but to the extent that you did not know my father, I will say a little bit about him and try to comment very briefly in terms of what set him apart a bit and what led the community here to remember him in this way. My father was, as the name suggests, born in Germany. He was born in 1928. He lived in Germany as a child until after Kristallnacht. He then went to an orphanage in Holland for a couple of years and then came to Philadelphia, where he lived until 1978, when he finally came to West Orange. In Philadelphia, he went to Penn and Drexel. He got advanced degrees in chemistry and in education. And basically, in terms of work, by day, he was a chemist for the Army, designing gunpowder. And at least in Philadelphia, by night, he was, and Sunday mornings was taught in Talmud Torah. And in terms of the community, he was, I think, a pillar of the Philadelphia community. He was very involved with the shul, with the school, and as Harold mentioned, he was central to the building of the mikveh in Philadelphia, and he was very involved in the shiurim there. And when he came to West Orange, I think he basically picked up where he left off. I think, to an extent, he probably distinguished himself even more beyond his communal involvement in terms of communal chesed on an individual basis. I think he was always there for people. He was doing all kinds of things for people and always treating the people that he did chesed for in a very dignified, respectful way. And I think that in some ways that surpassed even what he did on a communal basis. In talking about my father and thinking about my father, I've often spoken in terms of trying to draw a parallel to Avram and the fact that the Torah goes so far out of its way, apparently, to demonstrate the enthusiasm that Avram had for mitzvahs. And I think that in trying to put a finger on what distinguished my father and what was special about him, one thing at least I would point to is his enthusiasm for Torah and mitzvahs. In Vayera, you see that Avram is he has these malachim who come to him at the tent, and the Torah repeatedly mentions that Avram is rushing. It says Vayarach Vigrasam and Vayimaher Avram Olal El Sava, and it says El Abokoras Avram Vayimaher Lasosa. So it repeatedly stresses that he's rushing, he's enthusiastic about doing this mitzvah of Hachnasas Arachim, and it also makes clear that he's doing things in a hands-on way. He's not delegating authority, he's not telling people what to do, he's not just overseeing, he's doing the mitzvah himself. He's getting the food, he's getting everything ready. And you see the same thing at the end of Vayera when you with respect to the Akedah, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avram that he's going to have to take Yitzchak and bring him as a korban, and what does Avram do? It says, Vayashkeim Avram Baboker. Avram got up early. He was enthusiastic about what he was being asked to do. And then, beyond that, what does he do? It says, Vayachavoshes Hamaro, and Vayivakah Seola. Again, Avram is seen not as just an important person who's delegating authority and overseeing, but he's somebody who's involved in the mitzvah and taking an active hands-on role. And I think that my father demonstrated the same kind of sincere enthusiasm for Torah and mitzvahs. I know when he first came here, he was dismayed, I think, by the fact that the shul, which is, I guess, a far cry from what it is today, didn't have a minyan that was early enough for him to go to in the morning. But when there was finally a minyan that he could go to in the morning before work, this was something that really made him happy. He was honestly enthusiastic about it. And whether it was visiting sick people or giving rides to people, fixing things in their homes, attending shiurim, all the different things that he was involved with on a constant basis, it was always with this sense of enthusiasm. And even in his free time, the things where, instead of hobbies that might be more common, the things that he enjoyed doing and took the most pride in were things like he made some shofars, and he would teach people how to tie scissors, and we had sukkah decorations that he made that were rather unique. Those are the things that he took the most pride in. Those are the things that he was most excited about. And I think it was that genuine, sincere enthusiasm for Torah and mitzvahs which made an impression upon people here, which they appreciate, which they admire, and which I think we could all hope to emulate.
There are a lot of people who they're crowded in the back. There's lots of room up front, and there are other people probably going to be trying to come in a little later. So why don't we have a mass exodus toward the front, perhaps? Our speaker tonight, Rabbi Yitzchak Breidowitz, is an associate professor of law at the University of Maryland, and he's the rabbi of Woodside Synagogue in Silver Spring, Maryland. He received his rabbinical ordination from Ne'er Israel Rabbinical College in 1976, a J.D. from Harvard Law School in 1979, and a doctorate in Talmudic Law from Ne'er Israel in 1992. He has lectured extensively throughout the United States and Israel on medical, business, and family ethics. He has published articles on bankruptcy, commercial law, medical ethics, family law, and halacha. He authored a survey article on the brain death controversy in Jewish law, published in Jewish Action, and is presently completing an article on the status of the pre-embryo in Jewish law to be published in the forthcoming issue of Tradition. When I guess I was involved in getting Rabbi Breidowitz, and what impressed me the most is that I asked one person about how to get in contact with him, and he said, well, you should go through Aguda, because he's well known there, and they would know how to contact him. Then there's another person who I know who was involved in a conservative synagogue, and he had occasion to ask Rabbi Breidowitz about a halakha regarding a procedure at a conservative shul. And I felt that someone who would command the respect of such a broad spectrum of Jews must be truly an outstanding rabbinical scholar and somebody that merited our attention. Rabbi Breidowitz is speaking about the passion of the Jewish and American legal system. That was
right. Thank you very much. I'm certainly honored to be asked to speak in memory of Mr. Stoffel. Although I did not have the privilege of knowing him, but reading what was written about him and hearing his son, who was actually overlapped in my tenure in law school, I really feel that we are here to give honor to an Adam Kashir, a very, very fine, upstanding, righteous member of the community, and it's my kavod to have a small part in that commemoration. My topic tonight, I fear, will not be adequately covered in the small amount of time that we have. If you'd like to stay till 3 in the morning, perhaps we could have start. And by definition, I'm going to have to be very truncated in the area that I talk about. Various selected comparisons, both on a philosophical and a pragmatic plane, between Jewish law and secular law. Let me just begin with a short thought that is stated by one of the great Hasidic masters, the Shem Shmuel. He writes that if we read in the Parsha later on in the Torah, when Balak hires Bilam to curse the Jewish people because he is afraid of the Jewish people going through the land of Moab. Right? The Pasuk says, Vayogar Moab, Moab was afraid. And the Shem Shmuel asks a very simple question, what is Moab afraid of? Hashem had commanded Moshe, Al Tatzar es Moab, not to wage war against Moab. The land of Moab was given to the children of Lot, and therefore there is no fear of a military invasion. The simple answer is, well, maybe Moab wasn't aware of that, but the Shem Shmuel wants to give another answer, and he says the following. What Balak was really afraid of was not that the Jewish people would conquer his land, that was foreclosed by divine command, but he was afraid of the Jewish people getting to Eretz Yisrael. What is so bad about the Jewish people getting to Eretz Yisrael? And the Shem Shmuel explains that there's a fundamental distinction between the type of society and the type of life and the type of relationship to God the Jewish people had in the desert and the type of life they're going to have when they come to Eretz Yisrael. Desert existence in the Midbar was a hermetically sealed existence. The man came from heaven and the traveling water supply, and they are surrounded with clouds of glory. There is no need to plant, no need to work, no need to engage in professional activities. It was a religious experience of ecstasy and separation and asceticism on some level that bore no relevance to real society. A Balak, as head of a corrupt society in the ancient world, was perfectly happy to have a Judaism that was irrelevant to daily life because it said nothing to them and it contained no reproach. But once they come to Eretz Yisrael, life is going to be very, very different. There is not going to be a Moshe Rabbeinu. There is no longer going to be the man from heaven. There'll be no traveling well. There'll be no clouds of glory. There'll be the need to have standing armies and dig dishes and plant fields and build cities and establish professions, possibly even have lawyers. That would become, I can say that because I'm also a lawyer. And the question then becomes, that the Jewish people would be demonstrating when they're at their best that holiness does not involve escaping the world. It does not involve repudiating the world. It does not involve turning one's back on confrontation with the secular, but rather there's a dimension of holiness that involves confrontation with that which is secular and the ability to elevate and to bring God out even when God's presence is concealed. Not to deal in a world of black and white where we can live in the white and let the black be outside of us, but to confront the real world of grays where God's presence is very ambiguous and requires a great effort and confrontation to see holiness in the darkness. That, of course, is a reproach to Balak. Balak could no longer say godliness is irrelevant. Balak can no longer say holiness has nothing to say to the predicament of our societies. And therefore, the Shem Shmuel, the Avni Nezer's son, made the point that Balak was afraid, at all costs, not to allow the Jewish people to enter Eretz Yisrael. Let them be holy, but let them not pose a challenge as to how we live in the world. Obviously, when we discuss the confrontations between American law and Jewish law, we are very much no longer dealing with a Dor HaMidbar existence in which Jewish law was the only system of rules that governed a person's conduct, and the issue of conflict doesn't arise, but rather, by definition, we are confronting areas in which we do have dual identities. Now, there's no question, there's no question, of course, that our primary allegiance, our primary identity, must always be as Jews. We are Ovdei Hashem, And if there are irreconcilable conflicts between God's word and the word of anyone else, as the Gemara tells us, Divrei HaRav, Divrei HaTalmid, Divrei Mishomin, the words of the master and the words of the disciple, there's no contest. And I'm certainly not going to advocate any type of dual loyalty, at least to the extent of some type of coextensive equality. Nevertheless, we do have to know that as citizens of the United States, Halacha itself imposes certain obligations vis-a-vis the government, which are encapsulated and described in a principle called Dina de Malchus Adina, the law of the government is the law. So it's not so easy to say Halacha is one set of rules and secular law is another set of rules, where Halacha itself incorporates within its fabric a notion of obedience to secular authority. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but you see where the nature of this collision course is going to take us, because in very many situations there are indeed conflicts between the dictates of secular law and the dictates of Halacha. But first, though, before I get into the specifics, I just want to make some general points regarding the role of law, of positive law, rules of conduct in the formation of the Jewish personality. And it's very, very interesting that often Christianity, classical Christianity, Catholicism and the like, criticized Judaism. In fact, the New Testament itself criticizes Judaism as being excessively preoccupied with legalism. Why, for example, do we have to have a whole book written by the Chafetz Chaim telling us when we are allowed to gossip, when we're not allowed to gossip? Just say, be a good person. Love the neighbor as yourself, which, by the way, of course, is in the Torah. It wasn't invented by Jesus. And then leave everything else to the human being's own intellectual reckoning. Why do we have to have rules and regulations and subparagraphs and machloksim and entire books? By the way, someone once asked the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote the classic work on the laws of Lashon Hara, speaking derogatorily about other people, and they said to the Chafetz Chaim, why do you make life so hard for Jews? Now, you know, don't write your book and, you know, let people say what they're going to say. Why do you make these impossible standards? And the Chafetz Chaim gave a very interesting answer. The Chafetz Chaim said, you know, if I didn't write my book and you wouldn't know the laws of what's Lashon Hara or what's not, you would not be allowed to say anything. The reason is because the transgression of Lashon Hara is an Iser D'Oraisa, is a violation of a Torah law. If one is in doubt whether they are violating a Torah law or not, one has to be Machmir. Safek D'Oraisa L'Chumrah. You couldn't talk at all. Now that I told you what you're allowed to say, now you're allowed to open your mouth. So the Chafetz Chaim said, Fakert, it's exactly the opposite. I made life easier for you, because now I've given you an ability to say whatever needs to be said. But the point is, it cannot be denied that Judaism is premised, the lifeblood of Judaism has found its expression in demands that God makes upon us. And those demands are often expressed in very specific ways. God is revealed in the world through the demands and the expectations that he imposes on the human race. And that is, of course, the Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah. And what that means, therefore, is the function of law in Judaism is not to, when I say law, I mean halakha in Judaism, is not to confer rights. It's a very, very different view than the American system. It is not to give me privileges and rights and entitlements, but rather it is to sanctify me by imposing upon me obligations. Now, to some degree, of course, to say I have an obligation to give tzedakah implies automatically that the ani, the poor person, has a right to receive. But this matter of vocabulary is more than semantics, because a halachic Jew does not look at the world by asking, what can I take from the world? What does the world owe me? But a halachic Jew asks, what is it that God demands of me? And of course, God demands that we do chesed, we do acts of loving kindness, we do charity, we do benevolence, and of course somebody's going to be on the receiving end of that. But the point is, the question is never, what am I entitled to? It is not a theology of rights, it is a theology of obligation and responsibility, and that results in a process of sanctification. Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous French author who wrote about American society shortly after the Revolutionary War, described American society, even in the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, as a very litigious society, where people were always insisting on their rights, that if your fence was one quarter inch over my boundary, I went ahead and I took you to court. And of course, his description has been borne out by contemporary society, where we live in a society of professional victimization. We live in a society where people are constantly preoccupied in discovering what new rights they can assert against other people. And again, in some cases this may be justified, but nevertheless the notion of always assigning someone else to bear responsibility for the unfortunate events that occur in someone's life is essentially foreign to the spirit of Judaism, which always stresses responsibility. And in fact, I believe it was last year or 2 years ago, you know, we have under the civil rights laws, we have special rules for suspect classes. These are historically disadvantaged classes, like minorities and the like, that are given special standing under federal and state law to seek damages or injunctive relief or the like. So I believe in L.A. 2 years ago, when somebody came up into a lawyer's and law firm and started shooting some lawyers at random, so the president of the ABA wanted to propose to Congress that attorneys be included as a suspected discriminated minority under civil rights laws. This was actually advanced as a serious proposal. Once again, you see how far the victimization mentality goes. The Indian poet Tagore, who won the, I believe it was the 1916 Nobel Prize in Literature, he was not Jewish, needless to say, once wrote that the human being is comparable to a violin string. When the string is taut and stretched, it is able to express the beautiful music within. But when you make it totally loose, cut it free, it is unable to express music. And the human soul needs discipline, needs structure, needs guidance, needs control in order to express the music that is within. We live in a society that stresses freedom from restraints, absence of structure, total liberation. And yet, where does that leave us? The Torah, on the other hand, very much stresses this notion of the disciplined commitment as giving the only true happiness to a human being. Certainly, we as parents know that if you give a child unlimited freedom, the child himself or herself is eventually going to be very frustrated and hurt, and the same is for the adults that we are. So that is, you know, one preliminary point to keep in mind, that the essence of the Jewish approach of halacha is not one that is oriented on the basis of rights, but it is one that stresses responsibility, obligation, discipline, and commitment, not merely to restrain us, but, as Tagore would have it, to allow us to express the song that is within, and to ultimately transform us, to make us holy people, people who are exemplifying the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God that is within. Point number two, which of course is inescapable, a corollary of point number one, is there can be no dichotomy between what is regarded as religion and what is regarded as law. We know that in a secular sense, law refers to a specific type of conduct that is being regulated, contract law, torts, property, securities, and then we have religion, the way one worships God. If you open up a chumash almost at random, you will see a cholent. You will see, in fact, if somebody would have to edit the chumash, they might be very dissatisfied with the order or the disorder in lists of mitzvahs. One pasuk might say, don't steal. The next pasuk might say, just look at Leviticus 19, look at Parshas Kedoshim. Another pasuk will say, don't plant different types of seeds together. Don't cook milchiks and fleishiks. Don't cheat your worker. Well, for the Western mind, that is very jarring, because some of those mitzvahs are ritualistic, some of those mitzvahs are in the realm of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, some of Bein Adam L'Makom. Why are they all in one place? And the answer is very simple. That's exactly the point, that God is teaching us that the way we behave towards our fellow man is not simply a social convention. It is not simply, as Thomas Hobbes or John Locke would have it, a social contract where I don't kill you in order that you're not going to go ahead and kill and steal from me, and it's a matter of simple self-preservation. But rather, this too is how we serve God. and to regard our business and our professional lives as somehow divorced from our Avodas Hashem is a fallacy that the Torah itself dispels every time you see a juxtaposition between honesty and business affairs and the obligations of interpersonal relationships and serving God in the purely ritual sphere. And thus, when people sometimes ask, as an unfair canard, why are Orthodox Jews not honest in business? There are two answers that one can give. One is, of course, don't blame a whole group for the sins of the few. And I think, you know, that should always be remembered. But I think the more basic answer is, I don't accept the question because the question is an oxymoron. How come Orthodox Jews or Torah Jews are not honest in business? My answer is, he who is not honest in business is not an Orthodox Jew. Because if an Orthodox Jew is not somebody who simply belongs to an Orthodox synagogue, but if an Orthodox Jew is one who accepts in their lives the yoke of the Torah and tries to live by the mitzvahs of God to the best of their ability, knowing that, of course, all of us will fall short, then the one who eats glatt kosher and wears tefillin and goes to minyan and daf yomi, but cheats in his business, is as rejecting of the Torah Hashem as the person who is Mechalel Shabbos. And perhaps even more so, because many of the people who are Mechalel Shabbos may not know any better and may fall under the category of the Tinok Shenishba, you know, the halakha category of the child who was never raised. But he who is learned and is not honest in business is in effect rejecting the mitzvahs of Hashem intentionally, and we cannot even give the justification of the Tinok Shenishba. So the dichotomy that we have between law, the interpersonal sphere, and the personal service of God, that dichotomy is foreign. The Torah obviously puts them all together, which raises an interesting question. You know, we have in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution the doctrine of separation of church and state. The First Amendment says, Congress shall pass no law with respect to the establishment of religion. And people often say, well, is Judaism in favor of church and state or not? Well, one thing I can tell you, in a Christian country, we're by and large going to be in favor of church and state, of separation, because without the separation, it's going to be the wrong church that we're going to have imposed upon us. However, generally speaking, most would conclude that in the ideal Jewish state, Eretz Yisrael, in the ideal messianic vision, one would assume there would not be a separation of church and state. The Melech would run the government, al-pi the Torah, and the like. I just want to share with you, though, one thought of the Ramban, which suggests that separation of church and state has a positive function, even in a Torah society. This is a famous Ramban, which actually deals with the matter of Hanukkah that is coming up, where the Ramban discusses the great sin in the Chashmonaim. Why did the Chashmonaim, who after all were the great liberators of the Jewish people, and they established a monarchy which lasted for over 150 years, why were the Chashmonaim so ignominiously destroyed and wiped out so that anyone that survives was considered to be a slave? Did not really, no one from the family survived. And the Ramban gives a number of explanations, but one of the points the Ramban makes is there is a special aveira for a Kohen, for a priest, to become a king. Kohanim were the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, and they shouldn't get involved in politics. Their job is not to get involved in political governance. Their job is to be the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people. And I would suggest that what the Ramban is telling us is the following, although again it's a little digression off the topic, but I think it's worthy of note. In the United States, we normally perceive of separation of church and state as a means of protecting the state from the intrusion of sectarian religion. Obviously, in a Torah state, that wouldn't be a consideration, because a Jewish state should be run by the Torah. However, the Ramban might be suggesting there is an opposite danger, that separation of church and state is justified because the church, the religion, becomes corrupted when it has to deal with the sordid realities of politics. And therefore, the Ramban is telling us, in order for the Kohen to remain the pure moral voice of the Torah, uncorrupted by desires to gain power and control, it is necessary for there to be a separation. And I think this is very, very relevant to the situation in Israel. I have said for a very long time that I am against, personally, the idea of religious parties in the state of Israel. I think it demeans a religion, and it gives the image of religion as just being another mechanism to capture votes, to trade votes on major issues in order to get a little bit more money for various institutions. And if religion would be a force that would be outside of politics, it could be a moral and objective voice, which all of the parties would have to respond to as representing the higher aspirations of it. But again, I mention this just as a thought, and I know that many of you may disagree with me, but it is something to think about based on this Ramban, which actually sees the sin of the Hashmonaim as Kohanim becoming kings. But anyway, that's the point of no dichotomy between law and religion. And by extension, of course, there is no dichotomy between law and morality. And that is to say, in a secular system, there is a clear distinction between what is legal and what is moral. Lawyers have to face this dichotomy every single day of their lives. Something may be legal, but something may nevertheless be immoral. Justice Holmes, there are actually two Maisalachir with Justice Holmes, where Holmes made this point throughout his career. One point is, Justice Holmes was once riding in a taxi to the Supreme Court with another famous judge who never made it to the Supreme Court, Judge Learned Hand, who was considered to be the greatest judge who never made it to the Supreme Court. He was here in the Second Circuit in New York. And as Holmes was walking out, Judge Hand told him, "Be sure to do justice today." And Holmes was already in his 80s, and he actually walked all the way back to the cab and said, "My job is not to do justice. My job is to administer the law, whether it is just or not." And of course, that is consistent with what Holmes wrote many, many times. Very early in his career, at the age of 40, before he even became a judge, he published a classic book called The Common Law, where he made the very interesting assertion that if we have a contract, there is no obligation on my part to keep a contract. Because, generally speaking, if I break a contract, all that means is that the other party could take me to court and get money out of me, which are damages for breach of contract. Now, most people say like this: you have a duty to perform your contract. If you don't, you will be punished by damages. Holmes said, let's get rid of that moralistic talking. The truth of the matter is, when a guy makes a contract, he has no legal obligation to keep it. He can decide either way to either keep it or break it and pay the cost. And therefore, Holmes basically said there was no such thing as what are called primary duties in law. There are only consequences. There are no moral commitments per se. There are a varying degree of consequences. Certainly, halacha very much, in fact, Deborah Holmes' phrase was that every lawyer must look at the law through the eyes of a bad man. In other words, if you're advising your clients as to whether something should be done or not done, you have to look at it through the perspective of what happens if I do what I want to do, what's going to happen? The eyes of the bad man, that's a famous phrase that Holmes uses in a number of his essays. Suffice it to say that Judaism says you don't look at the law through the eyes of a bad man, because you got to be a good man, got to be a good person. The Torah says, "Kedoshim tiyu," be a holy person. I'm sure many of you have heard the famous comment of the Ramban. The Ramban asks in Parshas Kedoshim, "What is Kedoshim tiyu adding? You already got 612 mitzvos. What is it adding?" And the Ramban makes the critical points that it is possible for a person to keep every one of the mitzvos exactly to the letter, but they can still be a naval birshus haTorah, a disgusting person, a repulsive person within the letter of the law, taking advantage of every loophole, every twist, every way of getting advantage from somebody else. And the Ramban says, the mitzvah of Kedoshim Tiyu says to a Jew, it is not enough to live by the letter of the law. You must live by the spirit of the law. You must be holy. Which is very interesting, which means to say, the prohibition against living by the letter of the law is in effect part of the letter of the law. One of the letters of the law is, thou shalt obey its spirit. But that is also in the letter of the law itself. I remember attending a number of years ago a convention of law professors. This is the American Association of Law Schools. And they have various presentations, and there was a presentation on the teaching of Jewish law in law school. And there were two presenters. One was a person who had smicha from Yeshiva University. He then went to law school, and he was teaching in Torah. He's not there now, but very, very erudite, knowledgeable young man. And the other was a Mormon who was a professor at Brigham Young University who got interested in teaching Jewish law. Now, where that comes from, I don't know. Neither the teacher nor the students are Jewish, but this was his thing. He taught Jewish law. The yeshiva-educated person got up, and he was trying to make the case for teaching Jewish law in a secular law school, which, by the way, is quite a common, particularly in the New York area. And he was kind of making the argument that we hear very often, that whatever you do, we got to. He was trying to say, oh, Jewish law is just as good as secular law does A, Y, and Z. Jewish law also has A, Y, and Z. You have analytical acuity, we also have analytical acuity, you have case law, we have case law, you have statutes, we have statutes, etc. So he tried to make his case. The Mormon then got up and said, wait a second, you're missing the whole point. Jewish law is not supposed to be like secular law. Jewish law is to bring holiness, sanctity, godliness. Interesting role reversal, that it was the Mormon who made the argument. And he gave a vignette from his own personal life, how the study of this law had an effect on him. The example he gave, there's a verse in the book of Devarim that if your debtor is unable to pay you, is going through temporary difficulties, you shall not be a harasser. It's kind of a law in the Torah not to harass your creditors. Again, you don't have to forgive them. I mean, you can maintain a liability for the debt, but temporarily you're supposed to desist from collection efforts. It's interesting how Jews are very sensitive to this. Even on Yom Kippur, before Yom Kippur, we say this prayer forgiving everybody for whatever they may have done to me, but we have a reservation, except for any money I can go to a base and collect. So we reserve our rights, but nevertheless, one does not harass. So he mentioned that he had lent somebody $500, and the guy wasn't paying him, and he was very, very annoyed, and he wanted to kind of call him up, send him a dunning letter. But then he realized, you know, I'm learning about this, and God is saying I should learn to forgive, learn to tolerate, learn to be kinder to somebody's financial difficulty. And he said it made a difference on him. And once again, that concept of looking at the law through the eyes of the bad man is not how a Jew looks at halacha. What can I get away with? But rather, what opportunities does Hashem give me to be able to serve him better? It's interesting that the preoccupation with legalism that the Jewish system has. I remember years ago teaching a shiur on the laws of Tisha B'Av. You know, on Tisha B'Av you're not allowed to wash your hands totally. You only wash up to the knuckle. This was a shiur to beginners. And one woman was very, very annoyed. She said, I can't understand. Does God care if it's the first knuckle or the second knuckle? Is this something God is going to be preoccupied with? And this is the old question. Why go into the detail? Why can't God just say, be good, and we'll figure it out? Like Christianity says, be good. And the interesting thing is that the legalistic nature of Judaism rests on two assumptions which to some extent are a bit contradictory, but they're also complementary. One assumption is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has an honest distrust of the infinite capacity of a human being to rationalize, to establish a moral code that is based on their self-interests. If God would simply say, do the right thing, and leave it to us to decide in every single case what's the right thing, it is a very short distance from determining what is right to determining what is expedient and what is easy in a given case. We are often deluded with whatever is in our self-interest. And of course, societies throughout the world have come to many, many divergent conclusions. Nazi Germany concluded that it was morally right to kill innocent Jews. We had, of course, an assassination of one Jew by another Jew just within the past month. So the concept here is that revelation is premised on the notion that the individual human being needs that guidance, because otherwise it could be when the Avos, the Derech Hashem says, for example, that the Avos were able to live a godly life without God's revelation of the Torah because they were naturally in tune with God's will. That's the meaning of the statement in Chazal, they kept the whole Torah before it was given. It doesn't even have to mean they kept every mitzvah exactly, but the primary sense is they were attuned to the moral universe, the moral construct that God had for the world. But we become tainted, and we need that guidance. That's one aspect of revelation. But the other aspect of revelation connotes that through obedience to this law, the human being is capable of achieving perfection. Now, Christianity taught that there is a taint of original sin. In fact, the whole argument of Paul in the Gospels, why the law was abrogated, was the following. Since it is impossible for the human being to ever through action, because whatever you do will be sinful and defective and wrong, ergo, it must be that God must have eliminated the need to do all of that stuff because it isn't going to help anyway. Therefore, all you have is faith and not works, and that'll be sufficient. Well, since we reject that idea of original sin, at least as that is expressed, what we say is it is the opposite. Through obedience to God's word, the human being can attempt to achieve a moral and spiritual perfection and holiness. The perfectibility of human nature through obedience to God's will, as opposed to the notion that the human being is incapable of achieving that moral perfection. A final point, again, as I say, this is still kind of in the nature of an introduction, but there's some central points that need to be get out, is that the law, the halacha, is so highly regarded in Judaism that we find that no one is above this legal system, even HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvodo uv'atzmo. One idea that God cannot be above the moral strictures that God has himself created is, of course, the incident of Avraham and Sodom. Avraham argues with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Avraham says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaShofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. He who is the judge of the world shall not act in justice. And Avraham argues, and Avraham shows HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you must behave in a just way. You know, we have this old debate among philosophers. Is good good because it's good, or is good good only because God has so willed it? Meaning to say, is there an independent essence of goodness and justice that exists apart from God's will, although God himself made that construct? Or is good whatever God happens to want at a given moment in time? The story of Sodom suggests that the good becomes a transcendent reality, good and justice, that even God himself willingly, because everything is an action of God's will, willingly subscribes to. The same story is brought out in the very, very famous Maisa in Bava Metzia regarding the Tanur Shalachnoi. The Tanur Shalachnoi was a certain oven, and there was an argument between Rabbi Eliezer and the rest of the Chachamim whether the oven was Tamei, ritually pure, or ritually impure. A majority of the sages decided one way. Rabbi Eliezer refused to accede to the decision of the majority, and Rabbi Eliezer called upon God to do a lot of miracles to prove that he was correct. He said, if the halacha is like me, let the water change its course. Like the Chicago River, they reversed its course, and they did it, and he said, we don't follow rivers. If the halacha is like me, let the tree uproot itself. And the tree uprooted itself, we don't listen to trees. If the halacha is like me, let the walls of the Beis HaMedrash collapse. And Rabbi Yeshua ordered the walls not to collapse. So the Gemara tells us the walls didn't know if they should fall or they should stay up. So they remained in a diagonal position, ad hayom hazeh, the Gemara says. And then finally the Gemara brings out the big gun. Rabbi Eliezer brings out his big gun. He says, if the halacha is like me, let there be a voice from heaven, a baskol, a divine voice that says the halacha is like me. And a baskol came from Shemayim and said, the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer. And the Chachamim say, we don't care about that either. Because the Torah says, Lo b'shamayim hi, it is not in heaven. Hashem himself gave us rules as to how the halacha is to be decided. And God himself cannot depart from the rules that he laid out. There are really two points in Tanur Shalachnoi, both of which are very instructive. Point number one is, as I'm suggesting now, that even God is not above the law. Again, this is God's own decision. It's not that we independently put God in this bind, but for whatever reason, it is God's will to be bound by the Mishpatei HaTorah. And if the Mishpatei HaTorah say that halachic questions are to be resolved in a certain way. God himself is bound. This, by the way, is the primary halachic reason why Christianity cannot be accepted as a form of Judaism, and that is because Lo b'shamayim, a prophet, cannot come with a message that God's Torah has been abrogated. That's the Lo b'shamayim principle. And therefore, any Navi, who, no matter what miracles they do, that tries to say that God has now decreed a commandment is no longer binding, any Navi, the Rambam says that is a Navi Sheker, that is a false prophet, regardless of his track record in the past. There is a point number two, however, which I think is something to consider in an era of polarization and hatred and machlokas, even within the religious world. And that is, it's a funny situation. God said the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer, and the Chachamim say, we don't care, we still decide the other way. What does that mean? I mean, God said the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer. What this teaches us is that halachic truth does not refer to a specific point. In other words, if we had two people, and one person said 1 plus 1 is 2, and the other person said 1 plus 1 is 3, at least if we're dealing with Euclidean geometry and non-Euclidean systems, you can have a different answer, then somebody's wrong. When you have a machlokis in halacha, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the Gemara says it's not the pshat that somebody's right and somebody's wrong. We got to follow one opinion. But in reality, Eilu ve'Eilu, Divrei Elokim Chaim, they're both right. It's like the old joke. They go to the rabbi and they present their case, and the rabbi says, you're right. And the other side presents his case, and the rabbi says, you're right. And the third side says, how can they both be right? And the rabbi says, you're right too. But the Mishnah says, Eilu ve'Eilu, Divrei Elokim Chaim. And the explanation is the following. Halachic truth is not a fixed point, but halachic truth is the result that is obtained by following the processes that are sanctioned by the halachic system. In other words, Hashem basically says, truth is indeterminate in a halachic sense, as long as the rules and the procedures and the competence, people who are competent to adjudicate, as long as that's followed. And therefore the Chachamim said, we follow the rules. We follow. If you think about this, a source of great machlokas between maminim, different segments of people who believe in Hashem, believe in the Torah, is people have different arguments over what is emes and what is emes. But we see that, in a sense, there can be multiple points of view, each of which have equal validity within the framework of Torah, because they follow the derech, the methodology and the mechanics by which halachic truth is determined. I should also note that I teach in a law school, and one of the movements, you know, every few years there are different movements in law schools. There's law in economics and law in literature, etc. But one of the hot movements here is feminist jurisprudence, where, as you would expect, various radical feminists try to say that all law is sexist. This isn't the old attack about how women are discriminated, that's one thing, but rather all law, no matter what, is inherently male-oriented based on dominance and the like. Well, it's very interesting that Jewish law, to a large degree, this might be a surprising statement, is very representative of the values that are espoused by the writers of feminine jurisprudence. Now, why is that? Clearly, Jewish law is not feminist in nature. I think we have to, without getting into that, I don't want to open up that Pandora's box, but no one's going to say that Jewish law espouses all of the individualistic causes of the feminist movement. But one of the insights that feminist critiques of law have suggested is that the masculine view of the self is largely one of isolation. A man, as a generalization, views his existence as a discrete unit that is separated from everybody else. And therefore, a masculine jurisprudence will tend to stress
how you can protect your autonomy and your separateness from invasion by the demands of others. A feminist view of the world, or a feminine view of the world, will tend to stress the notion of community, solidarity, togetherness. And in that sense, without getting into the male-female issue, it is very, very clear that the orientation of halakha is feminist in that particular sense, because we always stress the responsibilities that we have to each other. You know, in the first week of law school, when law students are still idealistic and they still kind of feel that they're entering a profession which will enable them to change the world, we always like to give students a hypothetical to demonstrate the difference between law and morality. And the hypothetical that's often given is, let's assume you just won your 4 gold medals for swimming and you're walking by and there's a 4-year-old child that is drowning in the river, and you decide, you know, you're not going to jump in, you're not going to throw a rope or a lifeline or a tube, you're just, you know, just going to keep on going, and the person drowns. Should you be held responsible for your failure to intervene to save that child's life? And the uneducated student who has just entered law school will normally feel this is so outrageous that certainly the person should be liable in damages or perhaps even criminal prosecution. And then we say with a triumphant smile, not at all, because under the Anglo-American law, there is absolutely no duty to intervene. The law merely says, thou shalt not cause harm. Don't hurt another person. There are no, in the absence of a contractual relationship, such as a doctor or whatever it is, there is generally no obligation to intervene and to protect. And in fact, we know, under common law, if you try to help somebody, you could be in a lot more trouble than if you did nothing. If the doctor rendered some medical assistance and something went wrong, there could be liability. In fact, I remember reading an article in Newsweek, around a month ago, where a resident said, you know, he had stopped to render emergency assistance, and he was so proud of himself, and he went back to his supervising physician and said, wow, I really, you know, saved a life today. The physician said, you are nuts. Never do that again. Because, you know, you could be sued, and the hospital could be sued, and everything else. Then we have good Samaritan statutes that create certain immunities, etc. The point is this. There is one verse in the Torah which totally repudiates the idea that my obligation to you is limited to not hurting. That is the famous verse, Lo samad al dam reicha. Do not stand by idly over your neighbor's blood. It's not enough not to hurt. It's not enough to create your little island of space where, as long as you don't bump into somebody else, you can be an atom that is floating in the air, you can be an electron that's floating in those massive empty spaces. But rather, we have a duty to regard ourselves, as the Talmud Yerushalmi says, "Kaguf echad," we are one body. We are one unit. The pain of any segment that a Jew feels has to be our pain. The joy of any other Jew has to be our joy. And the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva says an amazing thing. The Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva has a list of those people who don't get a share in the world to come. And the Rambam says, you know, a person could be an idol worshiper, a person could be Michal Shabbos, a person could eat non-kosher food, and that's a chait, and if he doesn't do tshuva, he'll be punished for it, but he'll still have a share in the world to come. But among those who don't have a share in the world to come, the Rambam says, is a person that is a poresh midarchei hatzibur, somebody who separates himself from the ways of the congregation. And the Rambam says, what is that? And he says, it could be a person who is keeping all the commandments, but he doesn't care about the welfare of the Jewish people. He doesn't rejoice when good things happen to Jews, and he doesn't feel particularly upset when bad things happen to Jews. And the Rambam says, by severing his connection to Am Yisrael, he loses his entitlement to Olam Haba. In that sense, Judaism is very much a feminist. It's a funny apposition of phraseology, but Judaism is a feminist jurisprudence because it is one that is oriented towards relationships, towards connectedness, rather than isolation and autonomy, which the feminists have identified as primarily masculine attributes. It's interesting, just to give you that sense, who is the famous, oh gee, I don't remember the author now, but Carol Gilligan, yeah. Carol Gilligan authored a very, very interesting and important book around 15 years ago, showing how the masculine mind and the feminine mind work in different ways, even at a very young age, in terms of does one view one's identity as an isolated entity, or does one view one's essential identity as being connected and bound in? And she gave the example of how little children responded to a moral dilemma. And that is, the moral dilemma was, let's assume you had to get medicine for your child who was very, very ill, and the child might even die unless you get the medicine. The drugstore is closed, and that's the only store that has the medicine in the area. What do you do? So males tend to view this as a linear progression, an either-or situation. Well, I either break the window and take the medicine, or I let the child die, and obviously in an either-or situation, one makes the decision to break the window and steal the medicine. She pointed out that women, little girls, tended not to view things as an either-or. They had a much more complex network of relational activities to consider, and that is, well, perhaps we could call this and make these phone calls and make these arrangements, and perhaps we could accommodate people, and perhaps there's a way where we could leave the money in the window. And she was asserting the idea that because the way they view reality is in connection with others, the notion of networking, connecting, dealing, interacting, trying to accommodate all the needs of all the participants involved was something that was almost instinctive to the way a girl thought. Of course, we all know that one of the key differences between men and women is whether you stop to ask directions when you're lost. No man that I know of, no man worth his salt, will ever stop and ask directions, and it's common for wives to be saying, let's stop and ask. And again, it even goes back to the fact that a male sense of identity is bound up with autonomy. Again, I understand that I'm generalizing, but these are, I think, largely valid generalizations. A woman's sense of identity is often, often bound up in relationship and interaction. And in that sense, there is a real feminist component within the Jewish tradition. Well, I have basically finished my introduction. I will just spend a few I will spend a few moments on the substance of my remarks, and that is these are kind of the structural components of Jewish law as a Jewish law system separately. The problem is, as I stated in the beginning, we do live in two worlds. Our more important world is, of course, our commitments to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and yet we are also committed to the legal system that we're under. We do know, we do have a principle called Dina de Malchus Adina that requires that Jews obey the civil laws of the government. Now, the Rishonim point out, obviously, this rule cannot be taken as a totally literal statement. If the government says, you know, work on Shabbos and close on Sunday, you know, you're not going to be able to work on Shabbos. And the Rishonim explain that Dina de Malchus Adina certainly has no bearing on ritual laws. You have to keep all of the Bein Adam Lamakams, whatever the government says. It really has very limited application to marriage and divorce. For example, the Reform movement, by the way, has abrogated the requirement of a get, because they argue, they make the halachic, I don't know why they feel they have to make a halachic argument, but they make the halachic argument that since under Dina de Malchus Adina, since under the law of the state, a marriage is terminated by a divorce proceeding, there is no need for a get. Well, suffice it to say that we regard that as spurious, because in the area of marriage and divorce, Dina de Malchus Adina has no scope at all. But Dina de Malchus Adina applies to the laws that a government enacts in order to protect society as a whole. So if there is taxation, which are designed to generate revenues for societal projects, if there are health environmental laws, safety regulations, zoning laws, and the like, we are halachically obligated to obey those laws. Now, this is an obvious point, but it must be reiterated because sometimes it is not appreciated in practice. And that is, for a Jew to willfully evade taxation, for a Jew to violate health and safety ordinances, for a Jew to even violate zoning restrictions, is not merely an evasion of a secular law, but it is a violation of halacha based on the principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Now, it would also be true to go over the speed limit, is technically, although I can't say that I'm totally blameless, but nevertheless, a speed limit is clearly a law that the government enacts in the public safety, and that is 100% in the sphere of Dina d'Malchusa. Just to show you how meticulous some of the Gedolim were regarding traffic laws and the like, I'm told that when Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, as that's how, was in a car, and he was driving in Borough Park, 4 o'clock in the morning, where there were no cars around for miles and miles and miles, he made the driver stop at the red light for the entire duration of the light. There was no flashing red for whatever reason, because he said, this is the law, we have to obey it. You know, so this is Dina to Malchusa Dina. I recall reading that Rav Yeshua Ber Soloveitchik paskind, and I'm not saying this lahalacha, and one should consult one's own Rav for this, that one is not allowed to buy at these various, you know, basement stores, which only accept cash, because essentially these cash purchases will involve not paying sales tax. And even if it's true that you're not the tax evader, because you could always say, well, listen, I gave him the money, if the seller wants to pay tax, they can do it. But nevertheless, if you know that the tax is not going to be paid, at the very least, you become an accessory to the commission of an aver. You may not be a primary offender, but you're what is called a misayeya lidvar avera, which is also considered to be a level of prohibition. So, dina d'malchusa dina is something that we have to be very, very sensitive to. I do want to emphasize the following, though, that dina d'malchusa dina does not permit the resolution of disputes to go to a secular court. In other words, if one Jew has a machlokas against another Jew, the halacha is very, very clear that that dispute should be resolved in a beis din, and it is only when the Jew refuses to go to a beis din, or it's very, very apparent that he would refuse to go, that one may be given permission to go to secular court. So don't take this too far. Dina d'malchusa dina does require compliance with governmental regulation, but it does not permit the invocation of a secular system to adjudicate the rights of a Jew versus another Jew. And let me just raise another issue about dina d'malchusa dina that might be very, very interesting, and that is, let's take as simple an institution as bankruptcy. You know, I teach bankruptcy, so I'm somewhat familiar with it. You know, bankruptcy has a number of features, but the bottom line of bankruptcy is, of course, the discharge. I mean, the golden pot at the end of the rainbow is that if somebody owes their creditors $100,000 and they only have $20,000 of assets and they want to file, let's say, a straight bankruptcy under Chapter 7, which involves liquidation, so let's assume $20,000 gets distributed, everybody gets, to simplify, 20 cents on the dollar. So what happens to the rest of the 80%, they don't have to pay it, right? Bankruptcy wipes away indebtedness. Now, with respect to a non-Jew, it's absolutely clear I can file bankruptcy because my obligations to non-Jews are only governed by whatever the civil law says. So that's not a problem. But the question is this. If I owe money to Jewish people, am I allowed to get out of that debt by filing a petition in bankruptcy? Keep in mind that classical halacha does not recognize the concept of a discharge. Granted, you cannot be harassed if you don't have the money, but there's no way, really, you can get the debt wiped off the slate. I mean, there is one way, that is Shemitah cancels out debts, but we can get around that very easily. You just make a prosbul before Shemitah, it's not going to cancel out the debt. So there is no mechanism by which a debtor can invoke to cancel out a debt. So the question is this. If I file for bankruptcy, and I get a bankruptcy discharge, and I'm stiffing my Jewish creditors, have I committed an act of theft in the eyes of halacha? Because not paying a creditor is a form of gezel in halacha, and if halacha does not recognize the concept of discharge, does it mean, well, what it might mean is, I can file a bankruptcy, get my discharge, but then I have to voluntarily continue to pay. Or can I take advantage of the discharge? So here, the emes is, there is a big machlokas among the achronim about this. I'm not going to give any final halacha. There are some opinions that take the position that to invoke a bankruptcy discharge against a Jewish creditor is a form of theft. And if you've gone through a bankruptcy, you must enter into some agreement whereby you will continue to make payments. And even in secular law, there is a mechanism by which these debts can continue to be paid on a voluntary basis. Other people have said perhaps we can apply the rule of Dina de Malchusa Dina, that with respect to the relationship between debtors and creditors, perhaps that can be structured in accordance with the law of the land. And if the law of the land, because it's a matter of monetary rights and property rights, and if the law of the land permits that restructuring, halacha would permit it as well. And yet a third view says a similar point, and they make the point that every monetary obligation, it is implicit in a monetary obligation that it is governed by the prevailing mores of the society. Right? This is called minhag, that the minhag establishes what the party's expectations were. Now, if I lent you money, and we had an explicit clause in the contract that would say, in the event I file for bankruptcy, I don't have to pay you, if that would have been in the contract, halacha would clearly recognize it, because that was a tanai, a condition, in the contract itself. Well, couldn't we take that argument one step further and say, even if it's not in the contract, but if the parties recognize at the time of negotiation that there does exist such an entity, is that not implicitly the background out of which the contract was generated? And therefore, because of the concept of the minhag, which incorporates by reference the prevailing practice, it would be as if there was an explicit condition in the contract. I would suggest that there's a fundamental distinction, a nafkamina, as it were, if we predicate the permissibility of bankruptcy because of Dina de Malchusa Dina, or we predicate the permissibility of bankruptcy based on the minhag incorporating bankruptcy as a term of the contract. And that is, a person can owe money to many different people. You can owe money to a sophisticated Jewish creditor that is well aware of bankruptcy, but you can also owe money to Aunt Tilly, who lent you $1,000 when you were going through graduate school. Now, if I say Dina de Malchusa Dina directly permits secular law to adjudicate the debtor-creditor relationship, then it makes no difference if the creditor was aware of the bankruptcy risk when she lent the money or whether she was not. Dina de Malchusa Dina can directly be operative. If, on the other hand, it is based on the implicit understandings of the parties when they made the deal, that type of halachic argument is only valid for the creditor that is aware of the existence of a bankruptcy. If you have an unsophisticated creditor who may not know of such things, you would not be able to use bankruptcy against her. So, halacha, these are the types of questions one would have to ask. And again, there are many, many other issues of conflict. Wills, which violate the laws of inheritance, how do they work? Again, do I apply Dina to Malchusa Dina, or do I have to, in effect, give away my property while I'm still alive so that the laws of inheritance will not be circumvented? And also, the whole issue of participation in the criminal process. And here I'll just take another 1 minute just to make a point about this. That is, in the Jewish lexicon of despicable, repulsive characters, there is no one as low as on the totem pole as what is called the Moser. The Moser is the informer, the one who turns Jews in to the secular authorities and result in the Jew either being imprisoned or money being confiscated and the like. Chazal even say the Moser is so despicable that he can be summarily executed without a trial in order that he should not continue his nefarious activities. The question occasionally arises, and unfortunately it arises with more and more frequency. What is the Jewish community's obligation when we have situations such as suspected child abuse or spousal abuse, whether physical or sexual abuse, when we have somebody who may have murdered his wife? I mean, we have had, Baruch Hashem, not that many, but we've had cases in the Orthodox community of people who have murdered, I believe, actually in this part of the country. And you will hear sometimes the refrain that it is improper for a Jew to get involved in the criminal prosecution of another Jew, because that is mesira, that is informing, and because it is informing, it's considered to be an evil thing, a very, very great aveira. What I want to tell you tonight is that by and large, that is absolutely not the case. And in point of fact, where a person's conduct poses a danger to others, particularly if the others are vulnerable children, not only is one permitted to take whatever steps are necessary to stop that abuse, but one is even commanded to do so. There is a mitzvah of Ubiyarta Hara Mikirbecha, to eradicate the evil from one's midst. Now again, I would concede that l'chatchila one tries to deal with it within the internal mechanisms of Jewish community. In other words, you don't immediately go outside. However, if those internal mechanisms are inadequate, if they fail to address the problem, then one absolutely must rely on the states. And in fact, one of the prongs of Dina d'Malchus HaDina is the laws of the states may be enforced by Jews against Jews if they are laws that are necessary to preserve the public order and if they are necessary for the protection of the lives and psychological health even of innocent people. So it should not be Masira. Now again, as I say, we should develop some internal mechanisms for many of these things, but until those mechanisms are developed, we use whatever we can to protect people's lives. So that's not an issue of Masira. I just want to say that you may ask, well, how come it is that if there's a principle of Dina d'Malchus HaDina, why is it so widely ignored? Why do people not pay taxes? Why do people violate zoning laws? Why do people not pay, whatever they have to pay? Why do they violate these laws? Well, it's very interesting. I had a historical explanation for this, and I heard that Dragan Kamenetsky said the same thing, so Baruch Shekivanti, and this is the following. The Rishayim already tell us that when you have a despotic, anti-Semitic, discriminatory government, one is not obligated to obey their decrees because they don't have the status of a malchus, they have the status of legalized extortion. And there is a concept of what is a just government and what is an unjust government. Certainly, no one's going to say a Jew is supposed to turn themselves into a concentration camp because Hitler, the Reichstag passed the law that Jews have to be arrested. So the concept was this. For most of our history in Gullus, we didn't have to obey many of the decrees of the Tsar or of the Polish government precisely because they were discriminatory against Jews and we didn't have to obey them. What happened becomes, however, that becomes a minhag. We come to America and we say, well, gee, in the olden days we didn't have to pay taxes. In the olden days we could smuggle. We can do the same thing here. Without recognizing, of course, that the nature of the society that we live in is fundamentally different. With all of the problems we have with the American lack of morality and the like, everyone, I think, would have to admit that this is what our Gedolim have characterized as a malchus shel chesed, a government of benevolence, a government that has given us freedom, a government that is committed, at least in theory, if not always in practice, to the formal equality before the law of all of its citizens. So it's clear that you can't use a precedent of how I behaved under Tsarist Russia or Nazi Germany or Poland to tell me I don't have to obey the government's laws here. But again, it's an example sometimes of a practice that became entrenched in a given society, but is not properly transferable to the society that we're in. Well, again, I apologize for going a little bit over. There's much more to talk about, but as the Kohen Gadol said when he read the Torah on Yom Kippur, more than I have said to you is written here, and Rishu Hashem, we should have other occasions. Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes. Those are very, very excellent questions. Question number one is the following. If this is a lawsuit between a Jew and a non-Jew, you don't have to be concerned with halacha because their relationships are governed exclusively by secular law and you simply follow whatever the judge instructs you. The only scenario where you're going to have a halachic problem is if it's a lawsuit by one Jew against another Jew. Now here, there's a certain technicality that can actually resolve a lot of these problems. If you're talking about a medical malpractice situation, normally
although it's nominally a lawsuit by patient against doctor, it is really a lawsuit by patient against insurance company. The insurance company is the party that is going to bear that liability. And therefore, the post-com do say that if, in fact, the party that is going to bear the ultimate liability is the insurance company, and we assume the insurance companies, the majority of their shareholders, are not Jewish, it's not a Jewish entity, you would be permitted to apply the Malchus under those circumstances. Now, that's a way out. That's not always the case. But by and large, therefore, participation in a jury would be permitted. The criminal cases, yeah. Once again, if the Jew, well, generally speaking, if the crime in question is a crime of violence which poses a danger to the community, this would include armed robbery, murder, rape, burglary, and the like, then generally speaking, the poskim say that since non-Jewish societies have the right to punish those crimes under the seventh Noachide mitzvah, right, of B'nai Noach Mitzvah al Adinim, you as a Jew are permitted to assist Noachide courts in implementing Noachide justice, even with respect to Jews. So it would not be Mesira. The condemnation of Mesira is when you turn in a Jew who hasn't done anything that's legitimately a crime. But when you're dealing with criminal enforcement, and I believe that the situation I talked about before about the individual who murdered his wife, this was a, I know that some of you are very familiar with this case. This person told his rabbi about it, and the rabbi turned him in. And the whole issue was whether there was a clergyman privilege there, and the rabbi took the position that he had an obligation under the Torah law to be sure that a dangerous person is taken off the streets. See, what's complicated here is the following, and I didn't mention this before except now for the first time, and that is, of one of the seven commandments of Noah is a commandment on non-Jewish societies to establish court systems to preserve the social order. And the point, therefore, is a Jew is permitted to facilitate the exercise of Noahide justice. And that would really be the key to that type of thing. Yes, sir.
Abolition of the debt by the bankruptcy fall into a different category and not be there because there was no interest payment.
So your argument is that bankruptcy is less justifiable when there is no compensatory, when there's no compensatory interest?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I would say, though, that since de facto, when there is a heter iska, even though it is not denominated as interest, there will be a rate of return on the funds advanced. It's not just, in other words, it's not just a principal loan, give me back $1,000. So I would think that de facto there is that compensating factor. So I would not make a difference there.
But if there was no heter iska, it's a pure $1,000, here's $1,000, give me back $1,000 in 2 years.
I think you have a good point. Other than to say that if you accept the position that Dina de Malchusa Dina can directly govern, irrespective of the party's intentions, it would govern in that case as well. It's only if you adopt the contractual assumption of risk that I think you have an interesting point. But, you know, that's not that common. I mean, the heter iska does not eliminate interest. It simply recharacterizes interest as a return on an equity investment of some type. Yes?
Mike, when you said we don't have deal in the right area, people have obligations as opposed to rights.
Yeah.
Well, an ani has, I think, an absolute right to look at and pay it. He has that right. A woman has a right to a ketubah. That's right. And I don't understand this.
Well,
that's that ani's right, clearly. Not.
No, I understand. I mean, of course, leket shichan peya is not even a debt. It's a property right. The leket shichan peya belong to the ani. They are the ani's property. Ksuba is slightly different. Ksuba is a debt. She is owed the money by her husband. Yeah, well, you know, you're correct. I mean, the problem is, there is no such thing as obligation without rights, because every obligation has a corollary right. My obligation to give tzedakah says somebody has a right to receive it. But the difference in conceptualizing it is that if one looks at life through the lens of rights, there is no room, as it were, to give in, there is no room to compromise, there's no concept of being mavater, and you press your right to the limit. If one focuses on my obligation and responsibility, then by definition, one is not in the business of taking, one is in the business of giving.
The other thing that wasn't clear, you said there was no way to discharge an obligation.
Yeah.
But there was originally a Torah way, not applicable today.
Which
but
is?
In Torah times, a person sold themselves as an eved, free to pay off his debt. And then the person who took it over, that was the way in Torah times, he discharged his obligation. He became an eved.
Well, but that's fundamentally the same as discharging by paying. And that's discharged by payments. Let me ask you this question. It's an interesting question. Let us assume that the person owed much more money than the value of his services would be for 6 years. I owe somebody $2 million. I sell myself into slavery. It is not true that the entire indebtedness is discharged. It is simply the indebtedness is discharged to the extent of the value that was generated by my 6 years. So all you're talking about is partial discharge by paying it off. I mean, that's not a discharge.
But there was no more future obligation.
There absolutely was. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if after my 6 years of service, the value of my services was less than the amount that I owe, I still owe the balance. So it's not a discharge. Now, Shemitah was a discharge. Shemitah's sabbatical year was a discharge. But as we know, at least, Hillel created the mechanism for avoiding debt. So Mechira as an Eved is not a true discharge in that sense. Yeah?
Just a quick point, though. Although we have an obligation to give tzedakah, we don't necessarily have the obligation to give it to this ani. No ani has a specific right on our tzedakah.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no that quid pro quo in such a situation.
It's not a personal, yeah.
I want to give it to
this. Yeah. The Gemara calls tzedakah and even leket Mamon She'ain Lo Tovin. It is money or property which does not have a specific claim. But of course, the Ksuva does have a specific claim. So you are right about the Ksuva. Yes?
What exactly is the onus when they violate the Ksuva? Every time I go over 55 miles per hour, every time I don't report them in the taxi, how would Ben have to theoretically deal with that case? A. B. You mentioned when you said you buy at one of these basic stores, it's Ayaya. Rather, you didn't use the Naiva.
Yeah.
What's the difference? And C, is there any difference by buying at a basement store that's owned by a Jew or by non-Jew?
Yep. Yeah, very good questions. Question number one, the question was, what is the punishment for violating Dina de Malchusa Dina? By and large, the Jewish courts have never developed first of all, no Beis Din really punishes today anyway, but the Jewish courts have not really developed a system of punishments for violating secular law, other than leaving it to secular law to enforce. So there is no onesh in halacha.
When you go over 55 miles an hour and don't pay your taxes, your ledger in Shemayim, you didn't get any...
Okay, yeah, I understand.
You get caught.
Yeah. Indeed, well, it depends. If the Dina de Malchusa Dina is the non-payment of taxes... No, I understand. I don't work for the IRS, don't worry about it. But if it's Dina de Malchusa Dina in terms of non-payment of taxes, the Aveira is Geza. You are stealing from what is owed to the government. Now, that's for taxes. Now, when you're talking about violating by going over the speed limit, I don't know what Avera you would call that other than the halachic obligation of obeying the law of the government. In fact, you may ask me, where is the source in the Torah for having to obey the law of the government? It's an interesting question. What is the makor? Shmuel said, Dina de Malchusa Dina. He's an Amora. What is the makor of Dina de Malchusa Dina? There are two makoros that are given. One makor is B'nei Noach Nitztavu al Hadinim, that the Noachide law that gives secular authorities the power to make these laws also means Jews have to obey them. That's source number one. Another source is the verse in Yirmiyahu, when the Jews were exiled to Bavel,
They were told, Dear Shu Shalom Hoir, seek out the welfare of your society. That is why many shuls say a prayer for the Shalom HaMedina, you know, whatever government they live in. It's interesting, if you look at the old Siddurim, you see a prayer for Tsar Alexander and everyone else. So that is a chiyuv. Dear Shu Shalom Hoir, so the Avera might be, you're over on one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. It's a very interesting idea that a Jew could be over on one of the Zion Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. So that's first question. Question number two, Lifnei Iver and Misayeya. That's a good one. Lifnei, just for the people who aren't totally familiar, Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michsho is a general rule that says you're not allowed to cause another person to sin. Now, I didn't use the term Lifnei Iver in terms of buying from or buying stuff from these stores for the following reason. And perhaps I could have used it, but the reason is the following. Lifnei Iver is transgressed only if the sin would not be committed without your participation. In other words, you're a but-for cause. The example would be, the Gemara says, that if I offer wine to a Nazir, and if I don't give it to the Nazir, no one else is going to give it to him. So if I give wine to a Nazir, I transgress Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michsho. If he could have gotten it anyway, but I extended it to him, I am not over on Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michsho, I am over on a lesser prohibition, which according to most Rishonim is not a Doraisa, it is only a Drabanan, and that rabbinic prohibition is called Misayeya Lidvar Avera. What was going through my mind is the following. If he's going to be selling all this stuff and evading taxes anyway, it's not clear that there's a Lifnei Iver. Now, you might argue, yes, but every purchase is a new violation. It's possible, but if he would have made the same number of sales with you or without you, meaning he'll have one more thing to sell, then technically it's not a Lifnei Iver, technically it's a Misayeya. If this is a sale he wouldn't have made otherwise, then there would even be a Lifnei Iver. Now, your third question, is there a difference between a basement store owned by a Jew and not? Very interestingly enough, there very well might be, and that is the following reason. Lifnei Iver absolutely applies to non-Jews. One of the examples of Lifnei Iver in the Gemara is, you can't give an Iver min achai, a limb that is severed from a live animal, which a goy cannot eat, you cannot give it to the goy because of Lifnei Iver. But the Shach says, the rabbinic prohibition of Misayeya Lidvar Aveira only applies towards a Jew and not towards a Goy. So, going back to this analysis, whether you characterize this as a Lifnei Iver or a Misayeya would have direct implications regarding the distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. See, a Lifnei Iver would be usher to the Goy because the Goy has to pay the tax as well. A Misayeya would be mutter. This is very relevant in terms of, by the way, can a Jew be a litigator? Can a Jew represent a Jew who is suing another Jew in violation of halacha? Since when a Jew sues a Jew, you have to go to a beis din. So if I enable my clients to go to secular court as a plaintiff, not as a defendant, as a plaintiff, am I transgressing Lifnei Iver? And the answer is, it's not a Lifnei Iver, because if you would turn down the case, they'd find somebody else to take it. So it's not a Lifnei Iver, but the question is there a rabbinic prohibition of Misayeya Lidvar Avera? Ask a rabbi about that. There is indeed a certain amount of discussion, but again, I want to explain that in much commercial litigation, the real party in interest is the insurance company, and that in effect removes some of the halachic difficulties that you would otherwise have. Yeah. Yes, I can, and I realize that was the advertising peg. You know, the topic is not as compelling as it used to be when I wrote up a list of topics, but I will say something about it. All of us know, those who have learned about the ancient judicial procedure of capital punishment, that by and large, if O.J. would have been tried under the procedures of the Sanhedrin, he certainly would have gotten free. In Dine Nefashos, there is no concept of circumstantial evidence at all. You have to have eyewitness testimony who saw the knife go in. Rabbi Akiva made the point that even wouldn't be enough because maybe there was a hole in somebody's heart and the knife went into the hole. You know, you never know, Rabbi Akiva said.
kind of like the Maryland Court of Appeals. No matter what happens, they always find, in like 30 years, they found some reason why some fact wasn't established to send somebody to the chair. And who has to be the witnesses? You have to have two of them. They have to be Jewish. They have to be adult. They have to be men and not women. They have to be Shomer Shabbos, of all things. I mean, how often are Shomer Shabbos people going to be hanging around a murder scene of that nature? They can't be Krovim. They can't be Psuim. So, by and large, the normal rules of the Sanhedrin would have meant that someone in the position of O.J. Simpson would have gotten off. However, the problem is you're comparing apples and oranges. Because, first of all, with respect to a non-Jewish defendant, a non-Jewish defendant is not subject to the laws of the Sanhedrin. The non-Jewish defendant is subject to the, even from a halachic perspective, halacha says non-Jews are subject to the rules of the Noahide law. Now, we don't have a lot of sugyas about B'nai Noach, but if you go through the sugya of B'nai Noach, the Sefer Achinuch says, based on the Gemara, that a Noahide execution can take place based on one witness. He could obviously be a goy. Noahide courts don't require Jewish witnesses. And the Sefer Achinuch says even confessions. You know, in Jewish law, a confession is not admissible. If I walk in and I say I did it, that is inadmissible to convict me. Why? Maimonides, the Rambam says an interesting reason. The Rambam says because there are many crazy people who love to confess to crimes that they never committed. And the truth is, in every investigation of serial murders, the police ignore literally scores of people who come up. They say, this guy calls up every week, you know, just don't bother with it. So the Rambam is correct on that in terms of what the reality. However, the Sefer Achinuch says, for B'nai Noach, confessions are admissible and circumstantial evidence is admissible. So one point to keep in mind is O.J. would not have been governed under the Mishpat of the Sanhedrin. O.J. would have been governed under the Mishpatei B'nai Noach, which do permit convictions based on circumstantial evidence. Second point, and this is a bit more controversial, even if the defendant would have been Jewish, if halacha recognizes the authority of B'nai Noach to protect society, it goes back to my earlier point, why there's no Mesira, halacha recognizes that Noahide courts can judge Jews based on Noahide law. So we have a two-track system here. Jewish Sanhedrin follows one set of rules, but Noahide courts have the power to follow Noahide rules, even with respect to Jews. And that is why you're allowed to turn them in and everything else, because it's not Mesira, because you are facilitating the performance of a function that Halacha itself recognizes. So that's really the point about the O.J., that you have to look at it not merely from the perspective of the law of the Sanhedrin, but through all of the prerogatives that Noahide courts enjoy. Yes, sir? If their legal structure is inconsistent with Noahide law, they would no longer have the status of Noahide courts. If formalistically they are committed, even if there are individual instances of misconduct, that would not deprive the courts of that jurisdiction. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. I think we had a very enjoyable, very interesting